anything about their kids. So I'm going to read you this little part. This comes from a story that a friend told me about this linen plant. One woman was hiding, and he put a box over her. You know, like a big refrigerator box. Nobody looked under the box. And then after everyone left, he picked up the box, and she went away. And that's a crazy story. And my dad worked at that place. He drove a truck for the linen plant. So I had in my mind what would happen to the children after the women were deported. Like, what would happen to their children who were left behind? So this is a combination of the mom. Her name is Serafina. And she also doesn't speak English. She doesn't speak English. She doesn't speak Spanish. She's from southern Mexico, Oaxaca, and she speaks Mixtec, a completely different language, which actually sounds almost like Swahili when you hear it. She's been discovered under the box by Larry, and she's had a kid with him. The kid is 3. Serafina held the Virgin de Guadalupe curled in her palm. The blue-robed woman standing on a bed of roses was still warm. But Larry had torn the oval picture from the glass candle holder, the veladora that Serafina kept burning all day to assure the Virgin's gaze upon her and her daughter. "This ain't Mexico," Larry had said, his eyes red as pomegranate seeds, and then he roared off in his blue truck. Without the image, the candle flame shook small and lonely as a glowing grain of rice. Elvia, her daughter, stared at the wick through the bare glass, and Serafina watched the tiny fire reflected in her pupils. The little duplex room had filled with the purple light of summer evening. Serafina smoothed the stained glass edging around the Virgin, but this was not enough. She tried to make an altar inside the kitchen, but she needed to pray inside a church. She needed santos looking down on her so she could ask them what to do. "Na'e," Elvia called to her in their Mixtec language. "Nducha yuhan nuni yihi." She wanted Serafina to make atole. It's like a hot drink made with ground corn and milk. To heat the milk with ground corn, masa, and sugar and cinnamon, but Serafina waited, her eyebrows raised. "Please," Elvia said perfectly. She had just turned 3, and she could say so many words. Serafina knew, "Please, thank you." Oh, sorry, are we not cussing? I'm saying, are we like recorded and you're gonna be like, "Please don't cuss"? Okay. Serafina, you never know. Sometimes that's on the radio and they're like, "What did you just do?" Serafina knew, "Please, thank you, money, pay, fucking cops, fucking truck, American, speak English, okay, sorry." She could say sorry, but she couldn't form her lips properly around any of the other words. She had said sorry a few hours ago to Larry when he whirled around the house and tore the Virgin from her veladora and shouted, "Ellie's American, okay? My kid's American." But her sorry didn't sound right. She needed to kneel inside the church at home, to touch the patron saint of her village, to rub Elvia with flowers and then lay them on the altar as an offering, because she needed to pray about what kind of life Elvia would have if they went home. So after she makes the atole and they get into the car, I wanted to read you this part. She touched the hot door handle of the black car named Nova, almost like a bride, a Novia. The car was Larry's bride, with heavy-lidded, jeweled eyes. Serafina studied the dusty hood. The car always stayed in the driveway, facing the sidewalk, to hide the blank square where the license plate should be. When Larry came home, he worked on the insides, tangled like pig intestines. And today he'd tossed the keys at her and laughed. "Drive back to Mexico," he said. "Get a life." Now Elvia slid onto the front seat, laughing. She loved Larry's truck. She'd never been inside this car. Serafina drove up and down the dirt driveway, up and down the dirt driveway, practicing. Then she placed the mug of hot atole in the black plastic tray on the seat between them. And when she turned the key in its silver circle, the car closed a dark hull around her. She couldn't breathe. The floor trembled. She closed her eyes and then opened them. She had come to California in the trunk of a car. The rumbling under her cheek had stayed inside her brain for days, and the oily air had stayed inside her throat. Black gas step, black stop step. She pushed on them, her own short legs reaching with difficulty, and Elvia screamed with laughter at the jerking movements of the car down the driveway. It jostled off the curb and into the street. A white tower. She figured the church would look like a white tower that she had seen when they first moved here. She glanced at the dashboard where Elvia pointed, and the knobs and vents and lights were like a strange altar, and one knob suddenly pushed itself back out. Elvia pulled out a fiery red metal eye. She snatched it quickly, and the car swerved. She was in the parking lot of the white tower, and darkness rose before them. She tried to push the stop step, but the car's mouth hit something hard. The windshield was black with leaves, buried in a thick hedge, and her daughter screamed. Serafina felt the burning pang on her own arm, and she stared at the knob in her hand, but it was the atole. It had flown from the mug when she hit the hedge. The thick white splatter on her own arm stung, so she licked and blew, cooling and kissing the burn on her daughter's arm. She was sorry, she was so sorry she'd made Elvia cry. Then she dropped the lighter into her pocket. She waited until her daughter fell asleep, and she whispered, "Kushu, say A-C-E, sleep, my daughter." She heard bells in the church tower, and she knew she could go inside now and pray. She hid the keys under the seat. She got out of the car. Elvia slept, her hand cupped like a tiny ladle. The leaves of the black hedge were dark and sharp, and she saw someone open a curtain and then close it. She tried the small door on the side of the long church, the double doors in front. Everything was locked. It wasn't like home. No wide blue door slanted open, no welcoming golden candle flames. And then she saw the woman across the lawn. White stone. No blue veil, no golden robe, no dark eyes, but her hands were held out in supplication. She was a santo. The eyes were blank circles, but Serafina whispered. She stood in the base close to the hard lips and touched their icy coolness. And she whispered, "Help me. Tell me what to do and I will do it." She lowered her face to the hands and she said, "Tell me. Tell me she will have enough to eat if we go back home." She heard a short whirl of sound then. Stone blush, white skin suffused with red light. She heard her own language soft and humming. She reached to touch the rope. Now it was flashing blue. And she heard, "Home. Go home." And then footsteps sounded on the concrete behind her. A man's voice said, "Hey, it's time to go home." His flashlight was in her face, the blue light twirling into the stone eyes, and she turned and ran. The policeman tackled her on the grass, lifted her by the elbow, and she dropped her shoulder and tried to run again. Her tongue rose in her throat. She gasped for air when he caught her again. And another policeman watched while the first one held her skull between his hands and said, "ID, ID, you got ID?" My daughter. She screamed the words. They felt strange in her throat. My daughter. Okay, you need a doctor. In Mexico. You can get a doctor in Mexico. He held her wrist with one hand and pulled her up very slowly. And she hit him in the shoulder. She hit him in the face. She had to run around the corner to the dark lot where Elvia waited in the car. But he pushed her down very gently onto the sidewalk until her cheek grew up the rough cement. Elvia screamed. She couldn't see the car. They carried her toward the flashing red lights. They laid her in the back seat, and she screamed and screamed until the harsh red light circled very close to her eyes, pumping like blood from a deep cut. The police car began to move. And she screamed into the vinyl as her body floated away from her daughter, who was sleeping, her head cushioned by braids. Serafina struggled to raise herself, to see, but she saw only the red light glaring, draining her, flashing in the same rhythm as her heart. So, you're a polite audience and very quiet, and I can't tell if you're bored. Are you bored? Or very polite? So, I think I'll read the next little two pages, which are Elvia's part, how she feels when she wakes up in the car. Yes? Okay. So these are the things I wrote when I was 19 in the car in the parking lot at St. Catherine's Church in a notebook, which I'm sure is still around in my house somewhere since there's like 30 people's stuff in the house. in the garage. I wrote that part that I just read to you, and I changed very little, not because I want you to not listen to your professors. I changed plenty later, just that particular part. I have no idea why I knew everything about Serafina up until that moment, but I knew this character, Elvia, very well, and I'll tell you why as soon as I'm done. So she's 3 and she's waking up in the back of the car. Moss dove in and out of the streetlight beam, banging against the window near Elvia, and then veering away in bursts of blurry white. Branches and leaves covered the windshield, pressed tight like a blanket of black knives. Elvia wasn't to touch knives. Her mother used knives to take the spines off the green cactus pads, and they could eat the cactus then. But once she had gotten spines embedded in her finger, and her mother had pulled out the tiny red needles with her teeth. Her father had gotten so angry when he saw the cactus today. She studied the red circle of burn on her wrist. Her mother had kissed the burn. Elvia licked it herself. Her mother would lick it and cool it again when she came back to the car. Where was her mother? The crickets resumed their shrill scraping in the black leaves. She had awakened in the front seat. Her mother was gone. The keys were gone. Where was her mother? The car had bounced over bumps and made her scream and laugh. It rocked like and pitched like a huge low-slung animal, raising its back over the humps, like a wild horsey ride her father had let her be on at the store. When was that? One time? Today? Where was her mother? The moths bumped harder against the glass. She peered out the window to see them dancing crazy in the light, dipping in and out of darkness. She saw the parking lot as empty and gray as if she were inside a cloud. She was afraid now, and she ducked down into the cave under the dashboard. The well of space was warm, just the right size when she drew her legs to her chest. The floor felt like evening sidewalk. She twisted her brain into a pillow for her head. She could smell her mother's cinnamon. And then something bumped against the other window, something pale, bumped harder and harder, and she looked up. The sky was light, the moths were gone, and a pair of white hands pressed like a snail's underside against the glass, around a wide face as bright as the moon. Elvia screamed and screamed when the man opened the door, and she screamed when he pulled her out and carried her away. Then she was quiet. She didn't open her mouth for months. "Where is your mother?" the man kept asking. A woman asked, "Where is your mother? Your father?" Behind her glasses, the woman's eyes were huge and dark as plums, and her hair was a nest of yellow. She touched Elvia's hair and said, "Pretty braid," and Elvia pulled away. She said inside her head, "Lasso." The woman touched her fingers and said, "Little hands," and Elvia put them under her legs. She said inside her head, "Ndaha." The woman put her in a car. At the first house, the mother was big. All Elvia could see was the hem of her flowing shift. Elvia watched the edge of material sweep past her on the floor where she sat. It collected carpet, strands, lint, crumbs, bits of paper. The dusty furred hem of the dress looked like the bottom of her mother's broom after she swept the kitchen. Elvia used to sit on the floor then too, her face close to the sweet-smelling straw as it traveled near her, teasingly close to her bare feet. Elvia waited for her mother. She didn't move from the floor, and she didn't speak. A boy came. He had a bruise as red as a pomegranate on his cheek and a thick white sock on his wrist, but it wasn't a sock, because when the big woman went to the kitchen, he hit Elvia across the back with the sock. It was hard, like a stone wrapped around his bones, and she didn't move. He threw a truck at her. She didn't move. She said nothing at the next house, where the mother had tongue-colored hair and the many children pinched one another over individual Cheerios and fought over every hot dog. She never answered at the house where everyone had braids. She was silent when the woman washed everyone else's hair in the bathtub, and Elvia's long black hair swirled around the other's legs like wet roots. She said nothing when the woman cut off her braid the next day. The black braid lay like a glistening snake in the white bottom of the kitchen sink. Elvia remembered her fingers wrapped around her mother's braid while her mother carried her on her hip. She remembered the smell of cinnamon and corn. She touched her bare neck. The woman kept staring at Elvia's eyes, the scissors rasping. She threw Elvia's braid in the trash. Elvia looked at the picture of Jesus on the wall. Her father looked like Jesus. If Jesus wore his hair in a ponytail and cut off the sides of his beard so only a yellow paintbrush hung from his chin, if Jesus was always taking his shirt off and cussing and getting mad. Every night, in every house, Elvia waited until the man or the woman put on the porch light. And then the moths would gather around the glass-paneled brass lamps or the bare bulbs, and Elvia would stay on the porch as long as she could. She watched the blurry white bodies circle and pause, and if she sat still enough, they would brush past her cheek or her shoulder. She was quiet, listening to the hum and quiver of the moths, waiting for her mother to come back. It's the end of that part. Always awkward, because, like, if you read more than one, then you guys are like, should we clap? I don't know what to do. I'm just going to sit here and look away. You don't have to clap. No. I'm going to read more. That's why I'm saying it. It's just awkward. It's just acknowledging the awkwardness. That's basically what my kids and I do all day. That was awkward. Awkward. I know, right? Poor guy. Many leaves. I have three daughters. They're terrible. Terrible people. I wanted to tell you that the reason I write fiction is probably based on that little moment on the porch. So I was raised with foster kids all my life. My dad left my mom when I was 3, and she was 8 months pregnant with my brother, and I learned to read. I thought this might be instructive for you. I learned to read when I was 3 years old because we didn't have any money. I think we had like one can of beans. I remember a clock, so we had a clock. I remember that. I remember oatmeal, apparently, and my mom remembers me not eating the oatmeal, and she says, then she punched me. And she said, my response at 3 was like, you can hit me all you want, I'm still not going to eat the oatmeal. So sad. So I went to a babysitter, and the babysitter was always drunk and apparently also didn't like children, and I guess also wanted to hit us. And see, if that happened to me, because I also was a single mom, I would probably find a different babysitter, right? Maybe? But my mom did not want to do that, so instead she came home and said, when I was 3, I'm going to teach you to read, then you can sit in the corner and be quiet and you won't bother anyone. And I was like, this seems like a plan, I guess. I vaguely remember that because we went to the library, the public library. She did teach me to read in one weekend when I was 3. My mom is terrifying. She's 4'11". She's from Switzerland. Has anybody here read Heidi? Yeah. So apparently my mom's life is Heidi the bad version. Like, I think Heidi was already kind of bad, and then usually when you ask my mom, she just says, I don't want to talk about it. And then my dad, the one who left, Brokeback Mountain, you've seen that movie? Yes, he was Brokeback Mountain, the bad version. I thought that version also was already bad enough, but apparently no. My dad's life was much worse. So both of these people were not only incredibly unhappy, but they should have never met when my dad went in to get a loan from my mom. Clearly that was not a good first date, that he went to ask for $50. They should have never gotten married or had me. These are things I just am saying. But since they did all those things and then didn't want to do it, I learned to read when I was 3, which is a great thing, and I'm very grateful. So I read a lot, and that's all I've ever done since. I read, I watch TV, I hang out with my kids. She just met me, and already I've confessed to not doing anything, right? I didn't even tell you about the TV. My class has heard about that. So here's the deal. My mom took in foster kids from the time I was 5, and there were 5 of us in the family, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You can imagine how much fun that was when we went to Kmart, right? And total strangers would say to my mom, have you never heard of birth control? And then I would just, the kids, fellow kids and I were just like, we're gonna go over here now because we don't wanna see what's gonna happen. So I was the oldest at 5 and in charge. But I had those foster brothers and sisters for 4 and 5 years at a time. And when I was 12, I had an 11-year-old foster sister we had lived in the same room for 5 years. And her mom was in a mental hospital, and her dad was in prison. And one night, as we're sitting at our sad little table eating whatever we ate, hot dog casserole is what I remember a lot of, there was a knock on the door, and it was my foster sister and brother's oldest brother who had just gotten out of jail. He was 19, and he wanted to see his sister. And I don't know how he found our house, but my sister went out onto the porch, and she had 20 minutes to talk to him. And after the 20 minutes, we could hear his car leave, And then my mom sent me out there to get her. And I went and sat, and we had a cheesy little, like, three, it was a tiny little house in Riverside, three steps, and one of those dumb porch lights that was, like, almost orange. This was the 70s. You guys are like, oh my God, you're that old. Yeah, I am. I sat there next to my foster sister, and she looked so sad. And I knew that this feeling was not because my mom was a horrible person. She was equally horrible to all of us. She's the meanest to me. She actually liked my sister because my sister had green eyes. So anyway, she thought that was cool. The point is, it didn't matter what my mom did. It didn't matter if we all ate the same food, because we did. We all wore the same clothes. She missed her mother. She missed her mother incredibly and intensely. And there's this beautiful word that I learned later that I instinctively knew was how I felt, that she felt. Bereft. Do you know that word? Bereft? It's not bereaved, which means someone has died. Bereft means, like, without. You are without. And that moment is what I was trying to replicate when I was writing about Elvia. So I just wanted to say that to you, because it's an odd thing to be that young, but, like, you feel like you already know something odd like that. And that's what I wrote when I was 19, and I stopped right there. I couldn't write anymore because I was 19. And all my friends had kids, but I didn't have kids yet. I didn't get married till the advanced age of 22, which in my neighborhood meant I was 22, and they're like, you're never going to be able to have kids. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go off to college now and get a master's degree. And they're like, why? So I did go off to college and get my master's degree, and then kept writing. And the story that Glenn told about the TED Talk is what I was going to tell you briefly about for this last book. So this was, I think, I started it when I was 19. I put it aside. I wrote three other books in between. I wrote a book called I've Been in Sarawa's Kitchen, which has a lot of football in it and takes place in South Carolina and then goes all the way to California. There's a lot of football. There's a lot of Los Angeles Rams football, and there's a gigantic pair of twins that whenever I would go to New York, people would assume I was writing about the Barber twins who played pro football. It's like, no. They're with two other books, and then I came back to Highway Moon when I was 34, and I finished it. So those of you who are thinking, like, oh my gosh, that sounds like a terrible job, maybe. I didn't know what Glenn had just said until I was 34, what I'd be willing to do for my kids. This is going to be an even sadder story. So I'll tell it briefly. I started this book 15 years ago, and this book I started when my middle kid, who's 24 now, was in kindergarten. And I was in charge of a kid that Glenn was bringing up, and his life was miserable, but I wasn't quite sure how miserable. He sat on my lap a lot on Mondays. We read stories. His shoes were way too big for his body. His shoes were like the size of bread loaves, and he was a kindergartner. He wore big, long t-shirts, and they were clearly not his. They were like maybe his uncle's or something. So I brought him some t-shirts, and I brought him some shoes, because I have 400 nieces and nephews, and we have plenty of those. He lived three blocks from me. 1, 2, 3. And I saw his mom in the parking lot when we left. She had 5 kids and I had 3. And I knew she looked familiar, like we went to high school together, or we went to a rival high school, or we saw each other football game, something. And one day, in October, and it was still hot, we went out on the playground, and he kept doing this. He lifted up his shirt, and he kept doing this to his stomach. So he's 5. It's kindergarten. He's a boy. I'm the parent volunteer for the morning. It's my job to be like, do you need to use the bathroom? He looked up, and he was so shocked that I had looked at him. And I saw abject terror in his face that I had noticed that he was doing something. And I thought, huh. So I looked away, and he looked away, and then I looked back, and he lifted up his shirt to scratch, and he had cigarette burns on the lower part of his stomach. And I said to him, we've got to go take you to the nurse. You've got a bad ouchie there. And again, with the abject terror in his face. And he said, a pot of soup fell on me. In the way that you say something when someone's told you what to say. It's 108 degrees that day in Riverside, California. No one's cooking soup. None of us are cooking soup. Also, if you're me and you grew up with a lot of foster kids and in a pretty violent place, then you know what cigarette burns look like, and they don't look like anything but what they are. So I took him to the nurse. My daughter was on the playground, like, you know, she was like 10 feet away, and she said, how come he gets to go in early? I said, you guys keep playing. I took him by his shoulder, and we went into the nurse, and the nurse took him inside, and when she unzipped his pants, there were more burns. Lower down. And then the nurse took me and put me outside and closed the door. And that was the end of what I could actually do, except for that he was back in school 2 days later. He'd been living with his grandfather, he'd been living with his mother, he'd been living with a lot of different people, but all of them said what? What did he say? A pot of soup. The grandfather said it was a pot of soup. The mother said it was a pot of soup. So that was October. In November, I took his mom a frozen turkey, and that's what I wrote about in my TED Talk. It's the stupidest thing I've ever given anyone, and I've never given anyone a frozen turkey since, because my daughter and I went 3 blocks. We went to her house. I had a bag of shoes and a t-shirt and a frozen turkey, and the idea that this woman would have wanted to defrost something and then stuff things up its butt and then cook it for a long time, given what she had in her apartment, which was really no furniture, and 2 very, very scary men who studied me at length and studied my daughter at length, was the dumbest gift I've ever given. Now, why write fiction about a kid like that? Why write fiction at all? Because I couldn't get him out of my mind. And no one's ever sort of quoted that one at an introduction. But partly we write fiction because we want you to feel something, right? And here's the hard part. It took me 15 years to write this too. So this is not an advertisement for fiction writers. It's really not. You guys are going, wait, the first book took you like 15 years and the second book took you 15 years. I hope you had a good day job. I do. I teach. I like it. It's a good job. I like talking to you guys. But the reason it took me 15 years to write that is because I had the wrong thing altogether in mind about my character. I thought that my character, Victor, who has been burned, not in the place where this real kid was burned, because I couldn't even write that, by the way. I could not imagine writing about someone who could do, like, I couldn't imagine the face of someone who would do that. That doesn't happen. But my character is burned in a different place, and he's burned, I'm not going to tell you what happens in case you haven't read the book, but he is burned in a place that he's able to hide from his mother. And I was working on the assumption that his mother was a bad person, and she was not. She was a damaged person, and so I'm going to read you 2 little tiny pieces, unless you're bored. Are you bored? No? I have no idea what time it is. Are we good? Okay. I'm going to read you 2 little pieces of the 15 years that it took me. I wrote this book, and again, I put it down. I wrote 2 more books, which might or might not be over there. I didn't look closely. And then finally, I finished this in 2011. So I was going to read you one of the very first things I wrote, and then I was going to read you the very last thing I wrote, right? So I have to tell you one more story. None of the stories are fun. I'm very sorry. But also that same year that I met this kid, 15 years ago, I was driving to work one day, and I drive past a street, and I'm up on a big avenue, and this is my father-in-law's street, and there was a young woman who was strangled, and her body was put into a shopping cart. She was very small. She was 17. But the idea of putting a body into a shopping cart, you see what I'm doing here? That's also very strange, isn't it? Like, to actually take a body, a human person, and put it in a shopping cart. And my brother-in-law, my oldest brother-in-law, found her in the morning. He was walking to the park at dawn, and he saw her, but he thought it was just a bunch of clothes. And then when he came back, he realized that it was a young woman. She was 17, she was pregnant, and she'd been strangled and put in that shopping cart. And her mother said, no one's gonna care who did this to my daughter, because she was a pregnant 17-year-old black girl, and no one's ever gonna find out, and no one's ever going to care. She said that was her little tiny quote in the newspaper, and that just broke my heart. So I realized when I was on my way to here that what I was going to talk to you guys about tonight was this notion of fiction and motherhood, parenthood, and fear, like fear of being separated from your kids or fear that you can't take good care of your kids. Maybe all those things happen to people, but for some people you become an actor, for some people you write fiction. So here's what I'm going to read to you. It's the fictional version, which is not the true version of all, of this guy finding this young woman. When Sidney came out of the taqueria and looked down the alley, he saw Glorette Picard on her knees, her back to a shopping cart parked near the fence, her face held up toward the shadows made by 2 wild tobacco trees that grew along the chain link, and Sidney flattened himself against the wall, holding the bag of tacos like a school lunch, and waited to hear the sound of a man's voice, because she must be on her knees waiting. The man would be against the fence, getting his money, or the drugs. Glorette, the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, had been sprung for years. She'd been living here, moving from apartment to apartment just ahead of the rent. He didn't know what her son was up to. But he didn't hear anything, except for the back of his shirt rubbing against the stucco, loosening a few rough grains. Glorette's eyes were open. She was about 20 feet away. Her face was upturned. Her lips were parted like she was having trouble breathing, and her neck was curved, long and golden. He'd never been with Glorette, and it was always her neck that he had wanted when they were young. Who kissed her neck now? None of the men along Palm Avenue who stopped in cars and trucks or brought her back here to the alley cared about her neck. They cared about her throat, but he cared about her neck. He had danced with her once in high school and let his lips brush down along the side of her neck as if it were an accident when he shifted, and Glorette had shivered. But she was with Chess then, and after that she met a musician from Detroit, an older guy named Sir Dakar, and when he disappeared, she was 17 and pregnant. He stepped away from the wall, and she didn't turn her head. She didn't see him. Or even worse, she did, and she didn't care. "Hey, it's me. Sidney Chabert, remember me?" But she might not remember him ever. He walked quickly around to the front door of the taqueria. He worked at the hospital. He listened to the doctors in the hallway and the cafeteria, the neck, the throat. The first time he thought of the difference, he was 19, a brand new custodian, and the words floated all around his cart: inflamed throat, broken neck. And then one night, I'm skipping to this part. He brought her a straw. He found her in the ER when he wheeled his cart, collecting pre-dawn trash, and Glorette peered at him from the bank of plastic chairs. She was still the most beautiful woman in the world, and she said, "Ain't you?" Her huge purple-brown eyes shimmered with fever. Her lungs were black from crack smoke, torn from coughing, he thought. It sounded like cellophane was deep inside her ribs. And she said, "Sidney, right? You graduated, huh? I missed the last 3 months. I learned all I needed to learn by then." She coughed again, and she grinned up at him, and even with all the smoking in the streets, her teeth were still white as mints, and her neck was marked with only one creased line, like faint jewelry. "You want to marry me?" she whispered to him. And he felt his forehead tight and dry from the heat of the hospital basement. He was ashamed at what he carried in his cart. "What?" That's what all y'all used to say in school, all you guys. "Just marry me, baby," she'd murmur. "But you wanted to, like, you know, think about all, do I think about you all day while you're at work? Right? Didn't you ask me back then?" Brothers had all asked her something. "Marry me, baby. Come on over here by the lockers with me, baby. Help me out with this pain I got, baby. Take down that hair and let me see it on your back, baby. Let me see your hair and I'll give you all the money I got in the world." She coughed again that night in the ER, so hard her body bent like a question mark. And then she fell onto the floor. He didn't even think before he squatted down and picked her up. Regulations, he was supposed to call an orderly. No, she was longer and heavier than his daughter. But she wasn't dead weight like a sleeping child. And he carried her through the triage, and the nurses said, "What the hell are you doing? You're Chabert. You're a custodian. Put her down." But he pushed through the double doors and went down the gray tunnel of hallway until he saw an empty gurney, and he lay her on her side. So that's the beginning of that part. Sidney is a custodian. Not based on my brother-in-law, but he's a character sort of like my brother-in-law who used to work in the basement, and they used to have to burn up the body parts, and that was illegal, and they weren't supposed to be doing it. And then one night, the police dropped off 500 pounds of marijuana and had them also incinerate that, and that was a very big cloud of smoke, and then the incinerator was closed down. And my brother-in-law lost his job. And that is a very weird story, but all those weird stories that people told me was how I made up his character. This one's appalled. She's just like, you're telling terrible stories. You're giving me the craziest looks. They are awful stories, I know. But I'm going to end with this, because I wanted to leave a little bit of time. That's the first story I wrote about this dead woman. And she ended up occupying my mind for 15 years. And I'm going to read you the very last page I wrote. And I wrote it by hand, yellow legal pad, same way I wrote everything I just read you so far, even though I'm not advocating that you use that, because it's really hard on the hands. And if you write on a really fancy laptop or a tablet, that's cool as well. But I want to read you this and then read you a poem that I just found by accident. And I'm reading you this part because it took me 15 years to figure out that Victor, her son, who'd been burned, left his mother. He never showed her the burns. He never wanted to hurt her feelings. And so when I started the book, I was mad at Glorette, and I thought she was an idiot for getting killed. And she was very beautiful, and why didn't she use that? And when I wrote this page, I want to tell you that you have a little tiny moon that we saw when we were walking, a little tiny moon that we were seeing, right? And it's hanging up over that way. And in my neighborhood, when the full moon comes out, you stand behind a palm tree at a certain angle. And it has to be in the winter when it's clean, because the summertime is just miserable. And yes, you can laugh. We don't have, it's smog, it's dirty, it's gross. But in October or November, if you put the full moon behind a palm tree, it's always windy and it looks like fireworks. And that's something that my kids remember. At night, when I was a single mom, I'd be taking out the trash. And I'd say, look, it's the palm tree sparkler, which worked for a long number of years, by the way, before they were just like, we're still not going to take out the trash right now. I just wanted it to be fun, and I wanted someone else to help me carry it. When I came to the back of this idea, and I wrote this, I guess I'm reading this to you so that you could see, you could get fiction anywhere. You can get it from something that small. You can get it from a horrible, terrible, sad thing that happened. You can get it from a little moment on a porch. But this is what I wrote about Victor. So Victor is someone like us. Victor's mom, Miss Glorette, had been found dead in a shopping cart. So you can imagine how he feels about his life, right? She's been a crack addict for many years because she thinks Victor's father never loved her and he abandoned her. And she was sad about that. She couldn't get over it. Victor himself was supposed to take his SAT the night his mom was killed. How many people in here studied for the SAT? And it was like the worst time of your life. Yes? Wait, only two people had to take the SAT? The rest of you guys didn't have to take it? We were like, I'm not going to raise my hand because it'll bring back horrible memories. And then I'll have flashbacks and I'll be rolling on the floor. Yeah, well, I have three kids, 26, 24, and 20. You think we didn't do SAT stuff at my house? Yeah, it was really bad. I have flashbacks too. I have PTSD from that, okay? In fact, my middle kid called me crying last week because she's going to take the GRE. And she was studying those words, and she called me and she was crying. And she said, I don't want to do this again because it makes me feel stupid. And I don't like feeling stupid, Mom. She does a good job. That's what I'm talking about. I wrote about Victor trying to study for his SAT, and the night before he's supposed to take it, his mom was killed. And he's going to community college because he couldn't get into a four-year like you guys did. And this is the end. He's now running a really strange sort of bootleg parking lot in front of the community college. And he's hired someone to watch the cars, for which he gets paid cash. And he is coming back from class and he wants to be a music writer. Victor finally began to breathe once he was in the classroom. The murmur of voices, the shoe soles on tile, and the rustle of paper. And when his class was over at 10 p.m., he walked across the city college lots. Wilfredo, his girlfriend's brother, was sitting on the edge of the stone wall, hunched into his jacket. Irwin's car was behind him. And Wilfredo has recently arrived from Belize, and he hates everything about himself. And Wilfredo says, I tell you, man, I'm not washing the cars. I only wash my own car when I get one. I'm going to get an Escalade, black midnight. Then Wilfredo stood up. He was 15. He hated his own name, his gold-edged teeth, and his voice. And Victor suddenly thought, everybody wants to be an American. He walked away toward the bus stop downtown, and Victor sat on the porch. Wilfredo and Mayeli's mom in Belize had been drowned by one wave. Not even a storm, just one wave out the blue. Mayeli was 7 and Wilfredo had been 5. Victor's own grandfather was 7 when the Mississippi River flood took his mother. And suddenly he realized, I had my mom. I had my mom till last year. And he thought of the palm tree sparkler. Better than fireworks. You could have it every month, baby, she used to say to him. Just look. Every month. But winter is the best, because the moon's all clean. The winter moon is like rain washed it. Every moon's got a name. Hunter moon, harvest moon. And you always got a moon, she'd say, right here. And you always got a palm tree, baby. He'd be sitting on her lap on some balcony, on some crappy apartment. They moved every 3 months, ahead of the rent. This apartment was called the Riviera. And she said, the Riviera, they got a Riviera in France, but we got a Riviera right here. And she put her fingers, like visors, over his eyes to block out the apartment lights. And all Victor could see was the courtyard palm tree, the full moon behind it, the fronds tossing in the winds, and their fringes throwing off silver fire. Thank you.